This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the UK and Denmark set timetables for taking troops out of Iraq, and a study shows voter IDs do hamper minority voting. Joining us on the panel are Michael Myers, head of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, John McWhorter, a Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press. Well, welcome, everybody. And the big news is that British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced that the UK will withdraw about 1,600 troops from Iraq in the coming months. That could put the number of British troops in the country below 5,000 by late summer. And the plan will happen only if Iraqi forces can secure the southern part of the country. Blair was optimistic about that.
The majority of Iraqis do not want it to be like this. They voted despite the violence. They know its purpose and its effect, and they hate both.
Well, British troops are going to stay in Iraq at least until 2008. But, Callie, is this a sign that the U.S. is really being left solo in the dust?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a sign also that Blair is having to actually give in to some of the pressure that's been ongoing since he joined with Bush in this. I was interested in the White House response to it, claiming it to be, this is a good thing, it shows we're moving in the right direction, you know, we're getting security. I think this is, you know, Bush, the cheese stands alone. This is it. I mean, this guy has been his solid backer from the beginning, and the fact that they have set a firm deadline to take some troops out, and by the way, in an area that has not seen the kind of violence that we see every day on our television sets, so it's a double whammy. They're not only withdrawing troops, but they're withdrawing them from an area that hasn't even seen the kind of violence, so that you don't even have the backup of the trained military people that equal to the United States, who are trained very well. So I think symbolically and in a very real way that this is the end of the end. And the fact that we're talking about a surge, or our president is talking about a surge, and his main ally is talking about a withdrawal, is significant.
John, before I go to you, I want to play you a little bit more of Blair, because Callie really raises the question of the whole issue of, is the country secure? Blair claims that this pullout is only going to happen if areas are secured. But let's take another listen.
The Iraqi forces have often proved valiant, but the various forces against them have also redoubled their efforts. In particular, in and around Baghdad, where 80-90% of the violence is centered, they've engaged in a systematic attempt to bring the city to chaos.
So, John, can the UK actually get out if, in fact, one of their metrics is whether or not they are leaving behind a secured area?
Well, of course not. I mean, they can leave behind an area that's secure for 10 minutes, but I think we've seen a pattern in Iraq, which is that there are forces there that don't want that kind of security. And I'd be interested to see if Britain will face that and leave knowing the unfortunate truth, which is that any area that they leave has a great chance of breaking out into chaos afterwards. There can be no graceful solution at this point. And I think that what Blair is doing is indicating the very simple fact that the American presence in Iraq fuels so much of the tension at this point that it leads to questions as to whether any other concerns, such as what we're going to leave behind because of our mistake if we leave, are things that we should consider. And so, really, let's face it, these people are going to be at each other's throats for a very, very long time. It's all a lot of them live for. They live for two things. If you're a Shiite, you live for hating Sunnis. If you're a Sunni, you live for avenging what the Shiites have done to you. And then they also all hate the United States.
That's a rather broad statement.
But it's also true.
All right. Well, I'm gonna let Michael jump in on that. Do you think at this point the U.S. is going to be in a position of trying to hold down not only areas that U.S. troops currently occupy, but filling the gaps? I mean, I have in front of me a list of coalition forces, and the U.K. actually has at this point over 7,000 troops, but you've got Denmark, which is also pulling out with 460 troops. El Salvador, not quite sure why they engaged, but 380 troops. Bulgaria, 150 troops. So, you know, there's some very small, if you talk about the coalition of the willing. The coalition of the willing, it was already pretty small, and it's getting smaller. Can the U.S. stopgap behind these people who are leaving?
Well, the coalition of the willing ain't so willing anymore. And as Tony Blair is bringing the British troops out of Iraq, Tony Blair is on his way out as well. So if you think that George Bush's poll ratings are in the toilet, if you look at Tony Blair, and his party is concerned about its own future in terms of Britain. Now, George Bush is not on the way out. He figures he doesn't get out for two more years, and as long as he's the president, he's not going to leave that oil behind. It's just that simple. And unless Congress gets the gumption and the guts to cut the funding and to assert its equal constitutional prerogatives and to check the excesses of the president, we're going to have more U.S. troops in Iraq. And the situation, as John suggests, may get worse because the coalition of the willing is pulling out and the U.S. is still going in or staying in. It is not a good situation at all.
Well, Callie, Michael just brought up the idea that Congress does have some power, but at this point, Congress has passed a resolution that is non-binding censure, essentially, of the president's position on the war. Does the Congress have the ability to do something with teeth?
The House did, not the Senate.
Yeah, I think Michael is exactly right. I mean, either do something or shut up about it at this point. Because I think there was a great deal of thought that once the election was over and it was a very clear mandate, or it seemed clear to everybody except President Bush, you know, we are not happy here. We have to do something, and there has to be a dramatic change in strategy and get out. All of those messages, that didn't seem to register with him. Now we have another huge message, his biggest ally saying, hey, we're leaving because it's not working for us. The last bottom line, it's back to the folks who should have been doing it in the beginning, and those are the people who represent us. It's quite a clear mandate. They've got to take a firm position. They have to cut the funding and stand up and be ready to take criticism that says we're not supporting the troops and go forward. Or, you know, maybe you follow what Hillary Clinton is saying, 90 days, let's get out. Whatever. Something has to be done that's dramatic at this point and firm and not just a lot of talking anymore. Not working for anybody.
John, you are at the Manhattan Institute think tank. Mm-hmm. Lay out for us. Think tanks actually played a huge role in the formation of the war effort, advising President Bush, the more conservative think tanks. How are conservatives and libertarians, people who are center to right, falling along the lines of what the U.S. should do?
Well, I should say that the Manhattan Institute was not important in that particular effort because it focuses more on urban issues. But I take the stream of argument that you're talking about, and my sense of it, to the extent that I have one, is that there is a loyalty to the president, a sense that the neoconservative imperative to spread democracy was an important one and that we ought to give it time. And to be perfectly honest, my sense is also that a lot of the people in question are beginning to insist on this in the face of mounting evidence, and it's becoming, as it is with President Bush, a matter of not wanting to admit that one was wrong. And if you ask me, it's not a matter of people having been wrong. I was very much in favor of the war when it began, and I defend it. If I were Hillary Clinton, I would very happily say that. I would stand down just as she has in not wanting to do an apology. But as chance has had it and as incompetence has had it, it hasn't gone well, and there's no more point in continuing. I think that's becoming clear to a lot of people on the right, even if they're reluctant at this point to say it publicly.
Well, John,
you're not running for office, so.
Before you jump in, John, at one point you said you were willing to go over and fight. So I'm gathering that's no longer true?
Yeah. It lost me when I realized I would not want to lose a leg for this, which in 2003 I would willingly have. Michael Moore and the limbs off in the film, I thought, yep, I knew that in 2003. Once I realized I couldn't go, nor would I want to send a child, I thought, there's something wrong with this. There is no longer any point to it. But I did not feel that way in 2003 or 2004. It just hasn't gone well.
All right. Well, I want to move on to another topic, but before I do, just want to remind everyone you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just hearing from John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, and Michael Myers, Executive Director, New York Civil Rights Coalition. And Michael, speaking of civil rights, there are voter identification requirements intended to eliminate fraud, but apparently they can also reduce turnout among minorities. A new study by the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University shows that the turnout in 2004 was about 4% lower in states that required voters to sign their name or produce ID. And for African Americans, it dropped by 6% in those areas. So are these anti-fraud laws, or are these the modern day equivalent of the poll tax?
I will not call them the modern-day equivalent of the poll tax. The poll tax had a very clear intent, and that was to disenfranchise minority voters. We had all kinds of tests implemented, such as how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap, that excluded blacks from the polls. This is not a modern-day poll tax. This is not a modern-day racial exclusionary test. There are reasonable measures that states have put into place to have people show that they are who they present themselves, and when they come to the polls, this not every district is Chicago. Not everybody who's dead can vote in every state in the United States. When I go to my polls, what people know me, but they nevertheless require me to sign my name, and they look to see how I previously signed my name so that I am Michael Myers, or I am who I say I am. So now, the real problem is when states may say there's only one form of ID we will accept, a government-issued ID. That can have a disproportionate impact, not just on minority voters, but on senior citizens and others who don't have government-issued ID, they don't have driver's licenses and things like that. That becomes a problem. That becomes a court test. But this is not a racial barrier. This is reasonable.
Well, let me jump in and go to you, Callie. I interviewed Donna Brazil, who's one of our contributors on News and Notes, for a book that I wrote that was about basically the electoral process. And she recounted a story in which her own sister was asked for multiple forms of ID, which is illegal. It's not illegal to ask for ID, but to ask for three forms of ID, that was clearly, in Donna Brazil's mind, an excessive effort and may well have been racially targeted. Is the issue the voter ID law, or is the issue the implementation?
I think it's the implementation. I think that Michael is correct that it's proper to try to make certain that the person who's voting is the person who's voting. But we've heard during the last election ways in which the use of this ID has frightened people. I'm reminded that in Georgia there were large groups of Hispanic voters targeted, and they said, well, when you come to show your ID, we're going to find out whether or not your relatives are illegal. And, you know, it's all this kind of stuff. That's implementation. That's allowing people to try to figure out a way to abuse it. And that's always going to happen, of course, but we have to know that this kind of scenario when minority folks have been asked for ID more often than not ends up being a scenario in which there is abuse. You know, back in the day when you had to show various forms of ID to write a check, you know, there are many, many stories of black people being said, okay, well, that's not a good enough ID, or that's not valid, or whatever, as a way of preventing them from being able to shop. So we've seen the abuse of it, and it's a matter of just trying to figure out how to make certain that the implementation of the law is in place.
Exactly right.
Well, do you think, John, that there are going to be changes in these laws and requirements or more monitoring leading up to 2008?
Well, I get the feeling that leading up to 2008, we're going to see a great push to have more of these laws instituted, because to tell you the truth, I do think that there is no reason to believe that there isn't a certain kind of operating behind these laws. Because, of course, the fact is that it's never been quite clear exactly what major fraud they were designed to counteract. I think that there's a sense among many people that these laws might be a way of discouraging people who vote for a particular party from voting. And that is unfortunate. And I think that in addition to decrying the practice to the extent that we cannot completely stamp it out, and it seems to be happening in more states, we also have to get out an effort in our community to just get people ID. You know, 10 years ago, it was considered big news that middle-class black kids tended to not do as well in school as you would expect. Now parents across the country, Cosby parents, are getting on their kids and starting clubs and groups. An effort has gone out. Same thing with black breast cancer among black women. We need a move in this case for people to get ID so that if there's any shadiness in this practice, we can not only complain about it, but also use our strength to counteract it.
All right. We've got one last and very little time issue. It's about guns. Now, there was a ban on assault rifles initiated in 1994. It expired nearly 3 years ago. Since then, apparently criminals have upped their war weapons, and now 20 departments across the country are upgrading their own firepower to AK-47 assault rifles. Is this simply staying ahead of the curve, or do we need to change the law so that there are fewer of these guns in criminal hands? John, I'll stay with you quickly.
Well, briefly, I'm not sure how we could keep guns like that out of criminal hands with enforcement the way it is. And so, unfortunately, I think that we have to give our enforcement agencies these sorts of weapons. It's a tragic thing, but we're stuck with it at this point.
Callie?
I worry about the escalation, and at least if there are laws in place, it makes it a little bit harder. I know that John is right that they get out there, but anything to try to slow it, and certainly I think the assault ban should be back in place.
All right. Michael?
Well, you know, we're in an arms war, and I remember the old six-shooter that was replaced by the 9mm in New York City, at least. AK-47 assault weapons, this was a far cry from when the London police didn't carry weapons, eh? We're living in a different world and different society. Even the Beverly Hills cop, he used to have to go to the trunk and pick up a shotgun. Now they want the shotguns inside the car with the police. We are in an arms war. The important thing here is that police have to have guidelines for the use of these more powerful weapons, including the 9mm.
All right. Well, Michael, Callie, and John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Michael Myers, head of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press. And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on the roundtable, you can call us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. 3330. Or you can send an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. And please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Next on News and Notes, two commentators share their theories on black history and whiteness, and a new documentary looks at black soldiers' contribution in World War II.